if I gotta get every member of my family and make sure you're mentally, physically, and financially busted, I'll do it. All you ever concerned yourself with was pressing weight, pressing weight. And all you're good for now is pressing license plates.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Greetings from Allentown is not taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 166 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston, and today I'm just realizing I set up my podcasting area completely backwards from the way I usually do. I usually have the microphone come out from the left of the computer, and I set it up on the right. I don't know why the hell I did that. Anyway, no use stopping now. We'll be taking a look at WWF Superstars of Wrestling from May 2nd, 1987. Now, I know I have great disdain for Vincent Kennedy McMahon and what a total scumbag he is. But in going through this show, and, you know, just he has very little to do with it. Yes, he's on play-by-play, but it's not like there's a lot of Vince antics that I'm going to have to pretend to like and overlook the fact that he's a completely reprehensible human being. And besides, putting all that aside, this is what I would like to term a mildly historic show. It's a Superstars from May of 87. It's after WrestleMania 3. How the hell could that possibly be historic? Well, I'll get into that in due time. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email show greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And do check out the other great shows on this network, which apparently there's like 12 of them in the last week. Kind of losing count. People putting out content like nobody's business during this time period. I mean, yeah, I was doing GFA live, and that'll be coming back soon again. Hell, there might even be one before this show drops, because I didn't do one over the weekend with Keithy. I'm just going to let it go for a little bit, but maybe there'll be something coming up in the next couple of days. But that definitely will be returning. I spend most of my time just trying to figure out stuff to really make him pop when he sees somebody on screen. Like in that first episode where the Honky Tonk Man is a babyface, and, you know, other little stuff like that that I really enjoy. Another thing that I enjoy quite a bit, as this is now, I've kind of lost track as to where I am in this quarantine. I think I'm doing it based on the number of weeks that I've worked at home, and this would be the 7th consecutive week. So it's been 30 consecutive days that I've worked at home, which probably the same for many of you as well. And I am having beer right now. Actually, who the hell am I kidding when I say ordinarily I don't drink when I do the podcast? I mean, after all, I can go all the way back. I remember doing that main event where the Mega Powers explode, and I, like, accidentally hit my vodka glass, and I made reference to it in the middle of it. But that was during the summertime when you could come and go freely. Now this is more of a necessity. You say, why are breweries and such, you know, necessary businesses? What's the term they use for that? Whatever the hell it is, it is in fact necessary, because I probably wouldn't be able to get through it. Now, the beer that I'm having right now, which you may know because it's rather famous nationally, is Dogfish Head 90-Minute Imperial IPA. This tends to be a little bit too heavy for what I usually go for, but I've been drinking a lot of 6, 7% IPAs of late, so I've gotten used to it. And some of you may have seen, and I don't know how this comes up on Facebook, where I did a beer exchange with some friends of mine over the weekend, because while I enjoy the beers of the Medusa Brewing Company, I would like others to enjoy it as well. So I worked out a thing with some friends of mine. They picked beer up from a local brewery closer to Boston, further away from where I live. And I went over to a friend's house in the parking lot of his condo, where I was instructed to put a growler of Belgian sour beer in the back of his car. Meanwhile, my other friend, who's a teacher, he has a 4-pack for me. I have a 4-pack for him. So we're about 25 feet apart, and I, you know, put my hand up, and I walk out, and I put the 4-pack of beer at about 12 and a half feet. He goes out, he fetches it, and he puts down the 4-pack for me, and then I go back out there. It was basically shuttle runs for drunk people, I think you could call it. But it is nice to have something completely different. You know what it reminded me of? That scene in The Hangover where they go to get Doug and they bring the $80,000, and then it turns out to be the wrong Doug. It turns out to be the actual drug dealer who caused the problem in the first place. Anyway, if you're looking for something non-alcoholic to do during this time, and this is something that I did about 3 weeks ago, is there's this home farm or farm steady or something to that effect. I should probably look this up and before I talk about it, where you can ferment your own hot sauce. And mine is done fermenting now. And I kind of just threw a lot of stuff in the jar and let it ferment, both green peppers and red peppers. So it's really more of a reddish color, although green and red makes brown at the end of the day. But it ended up being a pretty decent hot sauce, which, while it has a bit of a funky smell to it, it reminds me very much of sriracha. And it's going to be my substitute for salsa going forward, because I bought 2 bags of Santita's tortilla chips and then forgot to freaking buy salsa the last time I went to the supermarket. And I don't want to go back to the supermarket again anytime soon. And they told me I couldn't even buy Claritin D because I was up against my limit for the month. Never mind that I buy 15 of them every 15 days. So you'd think that because I'm only buying one pill per day, that I would not go over the limit. But who knows how that goes? I mean, we have to look out for, you know, the freaking people in Iowa who might, you know, crush it up and make meth or whatever with it. And if you think I'm picking on Iowa, just take a look, okay? It is, and I apologize to anybody who lives in the state of Iowa who is listening to this podcast, but you are one of our most useless states. You have a stupid presidential nominating thing where, oh, we get to go first. And I know New Hampshire is pretty much the same way, but at least they have primaries where people vote like normal human beings. You guys have these stupid caucuses that, oh yeah, you have to show up at the freaking middle school and stand in a corner for 3 hours unless your candidate doesn't get enough support. Then you have to move over to the other corner and stand there for 2 hours. Like, what the hell is the point of caucuses in a primary? It makes absolutely no sense. Nobody has time for it. This isn't 1880 anymore, thank God, although I feel like a pandemic might have been handled a little bit better back in 1880 under the administration of Rutherford B. Hayes, who's a pretty terrible president, all things considered, but it was a corrupt bargain that ended up putting him in office. Remember when I used to read books about stuff like that? I should go back to reading books. Instead, I'll just continue watching old NBA games on YouTube as I continue my way through the 1987 playoffs. I just have to plow through the finals and watch the Celtics get their ass kicked several times and really just deal with it. So why don't I just put that at the back of my mind? Because, as I said earlier, this is a mildly historic WWF show. And yeah, it's the same day as a Saturday night's main event, which is obviously much more memorable. It's done for a national audience, but there are a lot of things on this show from Worcester, Massachusetts. Yes, GFA Live, we did the SummerSlam Spectacular from 1991 from that same venue. But the Worcester Centrum in 1987 was a viable alternative for acts, events, what have you, to the Boston Garden when Bruce Springsteen does the Tunnel of Love tour starting in February of 1988. Not only does he not play the Boston Garden, but he starts the tour in the Worcester Centrum, figuring it's a pretty good central location to both. It's, yeah, obviously it's closer to Boston, but you pull in people from Connecticut and even the True Blue fans from New York. So enough about Worcester. This is the first WWF show in the United States of any kind after WrestleMania 3. Now, this was taped on April 23rd, so it was not like they do it the night after Mania, or in the case of something like WrestleMania 7 back in 91, where they taped Superstars and Challenge 2 and then 3 days after WrestleMania that year. There were a few shows in Eastern Canada, but 25 days between WrestleMania 3 and this, because they had pre-taped everything before Mania for the first couple of weeks after WrestleMania 3. This taping saw the last appearance of Missy Hyatt. Now, if you may not know, but a lot of people who have followed these sort of things know that Missy Hyatt was brought in by the WWF to have segments that were intended to be Missy's Manor, which, think of Ric Flair's Flair for the Gold set. It kind of reminds me of that from what I've seen on TV. And she did several of these segments for the crowd in Worcester, and none of them aired because they were not very good. And here's an example.
Careful the way you talk to the Macho Man Randy Savage. That would be real good, and it would be healthy too.
Please, just, you know, calm down. You know, there are so many questions that I just want to ask you, but there's one thing I want to ask Elizabeth that I and so many other people out there have probably been wondering for about 2 years now. Elizabeth, what is a nice girl like you doing with a guy like this?
It is kind of funny that Missy was doing this at the same time she's in the UWF. I mean, I covered that about 10 episodes ago when I did the two UWF shows back to back. And she does not sound comfortable in the least, except for that one episode where she had the K&M connection on there and she was hitting on Tom Zenk. Definitely right in her element. This is also the taping, where Bruce Pritchard and one of his older Something to Wrestle With episodes. This is where he says that he had come in to the company, which also makes sense considering he was fleeing the UWF as well. He's the ring announcer on that last show that I covered that aired April 25th, but was taped about 2-3 weeks ahead of that. Mel Phillips gets a foot in the door, subbing for Howard Finkel, which is a shame, because not only because it's Howard Finkel that we're missing out on here, but because, well, we have to listen to Mel Phillips and think about all the stuff that he's done in his past. And finally, Ken Patera returns to the World Wrestling Federation on this show. They've been running vignettes of him in the weeks previous to this to kind of set everything up. The Ken Patera story, where he talks about going to jail and how Bobby Heenan had treated him, or more accurately, abandoned him, and the way that they wanted to frame the whole story. But I'm going to leave that, because on this show is the infamous debate between Ken Patera and Bobby Heenan. It's just rather fascinating how it all played out. I'm certainly going to have a lot to say about that. The attendance for this show is very interesting to me, because for that SummerSlam Spectacular, they listed an attendance of over 14,000, which I thought sounded high, because I thought that the attendance for the Worcester Centrum, or the capacity, that is, was more like 12,000. Here, it says 9,805 as a sellout, which is still pretty damn good, all things considered, because there was a lot going on in the Boston area that night. The Celtics, who were the number one team in town, were at the Garden, game one against the Chicago Bulls in the playoffs, and yes, I've watched this on YouTube, a 108-104 victory over Jordan and the Bulls. Probably not covered a great deal, the 87 Bulls, in that Jordan documentary that's been airing on ESPN that I'm not watching at the moment, because I feel like every week there's going to be one thing in that really pisses me off. That first week it was Scottie Pippen whining about being underpaid. This is a guy who, by the way, took farm subsidies from the federal government in the late 90s, after the point where he was making over $10 million at the Portland Trailblazers or the Houston Rockets or wherever the hell it was that he went after his career. And then this week, Isaiah Thomas being on there, one of the all-time phonies in the history of sports. I don't know how anybody can like Isaiah, even Pistons fans. I mean, how can you stand that guy? What a complete a-hole that guy is. So back to my point about attendance. My Bruins had been eliminated from the playoffs, swept by Montreal. This was during that period where they would just get swept by Montreal every year and just would be quickly forgotten. The Red Sox, they were struggling along in the 75th anniversary season of Fenway Park after not re-signing Rich Gedman because of their colluding against free agents, although there might be more to that story. But, say, they were able to get kids in the building because it was April school vacation week in the state of Massachusetts. So that does explain why you could draw a pretty good crowd and pretty smart to have your TV taping during the school vacation week in Massachusetts, especially when you're going to have a lot of interesting things on this show, like the Patera-Heenan debate that kind of goes sideways after a little bit, because Heenan, and I'll talk about this when I get to the segment, he takes a valid debate tactic, which I used at one time in college, which I don't feel great about, but it was pretty much my only option at the time. The Macho Man, Randy Savage, is in the house. He is no longer the Intercontinental Champion, and people are taunting him about it, so clearly he's a little bit pissed off. As mentioned, the Can-Am Connection, Tom Zank and Rick Martel. Adrian Adonis makes his one and only post-WrestleMania 3 appearance. I'd say that that qualifies under mildly historic. And Brutus Beefcake becomes a barber officially on the show, facing off against his former manager, Luscious Johnny V. Odd match to have on TV, but again, you got the May sweeps. This is when they have feature matches like this, so it all sort of makes sense. That's WWF 1987. When I started doing this podcast, I thought I might just do all of these shows like in a row, and there's a lot of 87 I still have on the bone. I mean, like that one episode where they just call Tom Zenk a quitter for about an hour straight. I can't wait to get to that one. Oh, the poor guy's passed away, but whatever. And why don't I just get right to it? WWF Superstars of Wrestling, May 2nd, 1987.
Wrestling Federation Superstars of Wrestling. Hello, everyone. This is Vince McMahon at ringside, along with wrestling's living legend, Bruno Sammartino, and yes, of course, from Hollywood, it's Jesse the Body Ventura. Stand by, we have lots of action headed your way.
If you're compiling a list of all the lies that Vince McMahon has told over the years, this one probably doesn't rank very high, where he would welcome you to the Superstars of Wrestling and say they are at ringside when clearly they are set very far from the ring. And I'm talking about even when they weren't doing it on a green screen. I'm not sure if this was green screen era or not, but we got Vince and Bruno Sammartino in the red jackets matching as always, and Jesse with the purple shirt that says Hollywood with the silver wig. So we want to go right into the first match. SD Jones, now from Antigua and the original member of the Bullet Club, with the little, you know, pistol action towards the camera as he is introduced, taking on the Macho Man Randy Savage with Miss Elizabeth. And he's referred to, as I said in the intro, as the former Intercontinental Champion. It's pointed out, of course, by Mel Phillips, who, you have to admit that Randy Savage's IC title reign lasting more than 14 months, an incredible feat. And there's nobody who understands incredible feats quite like Mel Phillips.
The former Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion, Randy Macho Man
Savage. There's the Macho Man.
Or don't you ever give me that smart mouth about former Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion. I'm going to tell you something right now. And SD Jones, you might as well listen to me. I am the uncrowned Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion. And also, I'm the uncrowned World heavyweight champion.
Oh, give me a break. Come on. Let's have some action here.
President Jack Tunney. And I'm telling you, don't do whatever.
The Macho Man starts roughing up Mel Phillips, which seems to be the popular thing for guys that I really like between Savage and Terry Funk back in 85. And also, it has the added side benefit of being, you know, you're tacitly sticking up for those poor boys on the ring crew that Mel Phillips made life hell for without going too far into that. SD comes in with a headbutt. And Savage can't even get his robe off, and he's doing bumps here with a slam, a clothesline, and SD headbutts him, and he finally is able to get his robe off. As Jesse is comparing this entire thing to the Marvin Hagler Sugar Ray Leonard fight, which I should probably watch because I don't know if I've ever watched that start to finish. Maybe that could be my new thing, just watching boxing matches from the past and just kind of breaking those down. Well, I'm certainly not very much of an expert on boxing. Besides, I should probably watch more of the old Ali fights like I used to when it was the Classic Sports Network until ESPN bought it and just completely ruined it. Anyway, the Macho Man Randy Savage in the year 1987, and I've spoken of this pretty much every time I've seen him in this calendar year. I call it his most interesting man in the world campaign, and it's got nothing to do with Dos Equis. It has to do with he starts the year red hot as a heel, as the Intercontinental Champion, where you could think of him on the periphery of the world title picture, as Savage considers himself, as you could hear from what he said. But then, after he loses the title, well, it means you get another 6 weeks of steamboat matches. It's the best kind of Groundhog Day, not like one where you wake up at 6 a.m. and you live the same day over and over again, which, again, is just feels like what I'm doing right now. And then Savage eventually morphs into a babyface in the summer where they have him trying out against heels on house shows. He's got a match against Harley Race in the summer. I think there's one against Butch Reed. And ironically, I don't even know if it would meet the definition of ironically, but that spot was opened up mainly because Steamboat took time off because of his kid being born, drops the title, so now you need a babyface on that side, because they didn't know, I guess, necessarily if Steamboat was going to come back the same way that he was. So you try Randy Savage on that side. And his face turn is so interesting, because it's all because he was pissed that some other guy was saying that he was a better Intercontinental Champion. Of course, that being the Honky Tonk Man. Outside the ring, SD, from behind, gets kneed into the ring post. So I guess if you can't make him do the SD Jones Memorial Charge, just force him into the post on your own, and things will work out okay. SD gets tossed back in, and he's laying on the mat, but he's laying in such a way where you would think Savage would go to the other corner, so like 90 degrees from where he is, in order to hit the flying elbow, because his feet, and this is not another Mel Phillips joke, is point in the direction of the corner in which Savage is coming off with the elbow. But that's not going to stop him. He ends up hitting the elbow anyway and picks up the 1-2-3. So a pretty quick win for Randy Savage against SD Jones. I mean, it ain't 1981 anymore. After the match, he goes up top again, hits the double axe handle, because we're going to get treated to all the Macho Man spots, because, like I always say, we on Saturday Night's Main Event on the Place to Be podcast, this guy makes the best use of the time that he is given. If you give Randy Savage 3 minutes, he's going to cram as much into that 3 minutes, but he's not going to do it in such a way where he's going too fast. Nothing. Everything he does feels calculated and deliberate. SD is sent over the top rope, but thankfully he doesn't hit his head on the guardrail like he did when Andre got his hair cut by Patera and Stud. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, he got his dignity raped. Double axe handle off the top to the floor. You gotta get all that stuff in. So this Randy Savage in the aftermath of WrestleMania 3 is out for blood. Kind of like the 1987 Lakers were out for blood after losing to the Rockets in the Western Finals and not showing up for the beating against the Celtics. But that's your 1986 Celtics moment for this week. And of course, Savage probably fired up because it was on this day in 87 that finally, on that night, Saturday Night's Main Event, he would face George the Animal Steel in a lumberjack match. The fourth time those guys would meet on Saturday Night's Main Event, I believe. Then, of course, there's the WrestleMania 2 debacle. Steals at ringside at WrestleMania 3 as well. So, thank God. Thank God that's over. Because everything is brighter ahead for Randy Savage.
Here are perhaps some comments from George Steele. George? Lumberjack match. Comments?
Boy, he knows a lot about it.
Well, I'm not too sure about that, but I'm looking forward to their final encounter this weekend.
Well, at least that's one promise that Vince McMahon kept. That was the final match between Randy Savage and George the Animal Steele. As we go into the update segment, which is Craig George at this time. He's now in that Ken Resnick spot that gets handed down from generation to generation, even though, yes, I know, Craig DeGeorge and Sean Mooney overlapped for a little bit. Which, by the way, for Sean Mooney, I knew about this and knew to look for it in the credits. I was watching the Baseball Bunch on YouTube. Yes, it's come to that, on Saturday night. And, yes, Sean Mooney was one of the producers on that show, one of five, I guess, kid producers doing that show. Of course, I learned that many, many moons ago when he did his interview on the Our Vantage Point podcast back in 2017. So the update with Craig, it's not about Matilda like the OVP podcast. All he ever does is talk about Matilda, because that's what it feels like the whole Craig DeGeorge era was. But in fact, this is about that Master of the Full Nelson thing that we, coming out of WrestleMania 3, Hercules and Billy Jack Haynes, which you kind of thought that feud was over, even though you had a non-finish. You had Billy Jack getting bloodied by Herc, which is startling that a guy is bleeding in the second match and then it's not Starrcade. What is kind of funny is it was not exactly the most surreptitious blade job by Billy Jack, and they replay the footage from WrestleMania 3, and you can clearly see him doing it. It's not exactly well hidden. I mean, it's not Buddy Wolf against Muhammad Ali, which I know I've referred to 100 times on this show, where he was basically cutting himself. The old Captain Lou move. Lou would do that quite often as well. But Billy Jack Haynes, and somebody else I think has said this as well, and maybe I've said it. I don't even know what the hell I'm saying anymore, quite frankly, at this point. Billy Jack Haynes, classic example of a guy who, yes, he looked like a star in terms of how he was built, but when you thought about him, you thought of him as a bigger star just because he was on WrestleMania 3.
I'm not claiming to be no better than anybody else, Hercules. I've said it time and time again. WrestleMania 3 in front of 93,000 people live, in front of millions and millions of people, national, international. Now, I hate to scream and yell like I said before. We didn't see who the master of the Full Nelson was. Now you brought the Shane in, and I've got 30 stitches in my head because of you pups. Now, bring the Shane all over the globe. I don't care where it's at. You and me are going to get this finished once and for all.
It's a pretty good promo from Billy Jack. He's certainly not lacking in the intensity department, but obviously there's more that goes into it than just that. There were other things that probably held him back that are certainly well documented. And that feud with Hercules is really strange in that before WrestleMania 3, they were doing a lot of, draw, non-finish, that sort of thing. And after WrestleMania 3, on most house shows, they were doing chain matches, and Hercules was winning. Now, I don't know if this was more of a screwjob finish where he would cheat, but he's effectively losing every match, including one in Davenport, Iowa, for the good, fine people of Iowa, who are the reason why I can't get Claritin on a regular basis. In any event, outside of that, Billy Jack is winning every other match that he's in, including the Honky Tonk Man in the month of May. So it's interesting, but he never ends up in that intercontinental picture again with the Honky Tonk Man. And by the end of the year, he's teaming with, who we'll see later, Ken Patera in a feud to try and avenge Brady Boone, the jobber, who had got taken out by Demolition, which taken like that, it's not going to lead to really good things when you're sticking up for the jobber like that. That's all I'm saying.
We're back now, ladies and gentlemen, and waiting for Johnny V to meet Brutus Beefcake. Johnny V earlier on had a few comments concerning his confidence for this one-on-one encounter.
Johnny V stated a long time ago that I determined that Brutus Beefcake was in fact the weak link, baby, and no doubt about it. Yes, I determined it a long time ago. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm so confident, Beefcake. I'm going to wrestle you here, right here, baby. And I'm so confident. I gave the Dream Team the night off.
This run for Johnny V in the WWF, which goes from 84 to 88, is just so strange to me because even though he managed the tag team champions for 8 months, I can't really remember a single thing that he did that kind of stands out the way you could with like a Jimmy Hart, a Heenan, and even Slick with his dancing and the way that he would talk. He was definitely, I'd say, the D manager, but he had a champion in his stable for pretty much the entire time. Well, not the entire time, but 8 months out of it. By the very end, he's relegated to the role of wrestler, which is what he is here. It's a very strange match in that, okay, I guess Beefcake wants revenge on the personnel man who got rid of him. Now, I don't really think of Johnny V for his kind of managerial acumen, nor do I really think of him for his announcing ability, because he was on the original Wrestling Challenge announce team with Ernie Ladd and Gorilla Monsoon. I know I've said that. I wish that Ernie Ladd had just been Morgan Freeman and done that thing where he's like narrating Shawshank instead of talking about the replay. That would have been so great. And made up for Johnny V, just kind of a little bland. I mean, and his shtick is a little bit annoying. Especially when you compare it and contrast it with Bobby Heenan, who, well, we'll see him a little bit later, and I got different things to say about Heenan, the personnel man, versus Johnny V, who a man who decided, you know what, I'm gonna dump Brutus Beefcake and I'm going to bring in Dino Bravo in the year 1987. Now, granted, in a kayfabe world where you have the hat firmly on, he's probably looking at Bravo and says, "Wow, this guy's really muscled up. Vince is going to take a liking to him." And after all, I went to high school. I went to academy with Vince, so maybe I can get him in that way. Instead, the new Dream Team is really just not a good thing at all. Just a kind of a waste of Greg Valentine for the entire calendar year of 1987. Who knows what else you could have had him doing. So the Dream Team has been given the night off. So that means that Dino Bravo can go out and push smokes, and Valentine can go out and, well, you know,
pass the fucking potatoes.
Love those Gene Okerlund outtakes. And think about Bravo and Valentine. They must not have real respect for their manager. I mean, knowing that he's going into this situation, and they have it out for Beefcake. Like, why didn't they just say, you know what, we don't want the night off. We want to have your back here. And, you know, in case something goes down. You haven't wrestled in a long time. I mean, who knows? But then again, you know, a night off is a night off. As Brutus Beefcake, of course, is now, as I mentioned in the intro, introduced as the barber. And so he's now Brutus the Barber Beefcake, as introduced by Mel the Chiropodist Phillips.
From San Francisco, California, weighing 263 pounds.
Look at that, Jesse!
A man who insists on adding to his otherwise colorful name, Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
The what? The barber.
Beefcake Barber!
Probably a mistake by Brutus to not go by Beefcake Baba, because then it could have left open the possibility of All Japan, and I bet he was talked out of it by Hogan, because I think Hulk still had some weird loyalty to New Japan and wanted to close that door for Brutus, you know, straight up. As Jesse wants Vince and Bruno to sit in the barber chair with Beefcake. I mean, hey, let's think about it here. I mean, Bruno, for the last years of his life, was, you know, completely shaved, which I think was a good look on him. He should have gone with that a hell of a lot sooner. But then again, bald white guys, you know, that really wasn't a thing until more recent vintage. And Vince McMahon, 20 years later, at that WrestleMania in Detroit, would get his head shaved by somebody, I can't remember who. But I'm sure it was a tremendous, tremendous job. The greatest head shaving in the history of our sport. Many people are talking about it. It did the best buy rate of all the WrestleMania. Okay, yeah, we get it. We get it. Okay, you got your 6 p.m. press conference going on right now. As Valiant attacks from behind, so he needs to get an early edge in this one. But Beefcake reverses a corner whip and hits a slam. And then an uppercut by Beefcake, sort of like a half-assed bolo punch, as Valiant goes flying to the outside. And we get an inset promo from Brutus, as, well, he starts to explain this transformation.
Why do they call me Brutus the Barber? Not because of Adrian, the little job I did on him, but because I'm going to do a little bit of trimming up this way, a little bit of cutting on this way, that anybody who steps in there with, Brutus the Barber.
This is born out of the Adrian Adonis feud, but what doesn't get explained enough on like the WrestleMania 3 telecast, because they don't play a video package leading up for the Dream Team match, because I don't think it's quite important enough in the whole scheme of things. There's a six-man match on Superstars in the weeks leading up to WrestleMania 3, and Adonis, they want to make the hair match with him and Piper, and Adonis has like scissors, and Rick Martel and Beefcake are in the corner. And Adonis cuts off the top of somebody's hair thinking it's Martel's, but it actually ends up being Beefcake's hair. So up until WrestleMania 3, Beefcake has this weird hairline in front where it looks like he's partly balding when he's really not. And that's where his anger kind of came in and why he was seeking revenge on Adonis in WrestleMania 3. Like, you watch that show in a vacuum, it doesn't make a lick of sense because they don't mention anything about that. But if you're watching the weekly TV, which is what I'm aiming to do, provide context for this sort of thing. But also, Pat Patterson, as the story goes, had the idea for the character because his life partner, Louis Dondero, was a hairstylist. And apparently that did it for him, or for whatever reason. But you can't argue at the end of the day that it was a successful character, no matter how you got there, whether it was, you know, it was organically born out of a moment that happened on TV. And yeah, maybe if it's, you know, because Pat Patterson gets off on it, so what? As long as the character gets over and, you know, everything else is fine. This is where I notice in the match that Valiant's trunks has... Now, I talked about Totally Awesome on the back of the tights of, I think it was Memphis Vice last week. And Valiant's trunks say, "I am a star," but it, instead of the word star, it is just a star. And it's like right in the middle of his ass, almost like it's like a... I don't want to say it's like a target or something, but hey, you know. And a reversal of an Irish whip, and Beefcake locks in that sleeper hold, and it is night-night time for Luscious Johnny V. So you have to wonder, what is going to happen going forward? And is he going to completely shave his head? Well, we don't have that kind of time on the Superstars of Wrestling. So he puts on the barber smock on the outside and just has, like, clippers. Clearly the act is not down yet. The smock would kind of go away after a while. I guess they didn't care as much about being sanitary later on. And instead, not unlike what we saw last week by Joe Ledoux, he just starts shaving one side of Johnny V's head. It's basically just like the left side of his head. And it's really strange. You think he's just going to give like the Boz or what I like to call the Brian Knobs look. He's just going to give him, like just shave the sides of his head and have, like, blonde all the way around.
This is outrageous. I can't believe this. Yeah, you laugh about it. I'd like to see you laying up there getting some kind of haircut like that.
20 years, Jesse. 20 years. Let's just play the long game on this one. Now, whatever consequences come after that, such as Vince's hair never growing in right again and him just looking weird from that point forward, well, we'll worry about that when we get there. So like I said, the barber thing, effective gimmick, he gets over until the accident in the summer of 1990. Who knows where it would have gone from there? I mean, I think that the gimmick probably would have run out of steam, I think, in 1991. That's just my feeling anyway. And I am kind of pissed, even though I was a huge fan of Brutus the Barber back in 1989 when he was getting the big push. I'm kind of pissed that he killed the hair match. Not that the WWF was doing a whole lot of them anyway. And actually, now that I think about it, did he really kill the hair match? Because, like, if they weren't doing that many of them, they were doing it in other places. Of course, it would be stupid stuff like Teddy Long versus Paul Ellering when neither of those guys had any hair. That might be the 10th time that I've gotten angry about that Capital Combat match with those two guys. And here we get another manager getting a haircut. But with that being said, he only shaved the one side of his head. Gives it a little bit of time to grow back in. You know why? Because at the Boston Garden on May 2nd, Adrian Adonis is fired by that point. More on that a little bit later when we get to the Adonis match, which airs after he got fired, which is kind of funny. Who takes his place on the road? Luscious Johnny V. And what does he get at the end of every match? They clip off some of his hair. You can't shave it all at once. You can't make the same screw-up that Mid-South did, booking Jim Cornette in multiple hair angles in the same week.
All right, Boston, get ready. Tonight is tonight downtown at the Boston Garden, the World Wrestling Federation, back here in this great city with the tremendous wrestling tradition.
Always good to get a show with the Boston local promos, and that show drew 11,834 to the Boston Garden on the night that this aired. So you got a triple header of action. You get the TV, you got the Saturday night's main event, and you get the Boston Garden show as well. I mean, the Celtics were between series, so the building is clearly available. Hulk Hogan, what do you have him do after WrestleMania 3 with Andre the Giant? Well, kind of a logical follow-up. You keep it with the Heenan family, but you have King Harley Race as the opponent because I don't want to say that's a dream match or anything, although anybody who knew about Harley pulling a gun on Hogan in the locker room in Kansas City, well, that'd be nice. Speaking of Kansas City, I ordered a bunch of barbecue from there, from Joe's Kansas City, and it arrived like super fast considering that it was being shipped ground. But then again, all the stuff is frozen, so I guess it is time sensitive. Gene runs down some of the other parts of the card as the Honky Tonk Man, still in his feud with Jake the Snake Roberts, dating back to the Snake Pit incident where he hits Jake over the head with a guitar. Now, Jake can't go in that match. He has torn shoulder ligaments, which happened less than a week before this, so it has nothing to do with a drug suspension or even any of the stuff with his neck. He gets subbed for by Ken Patera, who, of course, we'll be seeing a little bit later. As Jake, he's a babyface, yes, but he's doing the promo here. They're still advertising him, so, you know, you can think whatever you want about that. But it's not like he became shiny, but he never really was a shiny, clean babyface. Always an air of mystery. And it is kind of gradual, because it's not like he's like, come on down to the garden and fans and get behind me as I beat the hell out of this Elvis impersonator.
I walk into the gardens, I'm not going to be looking at all the knickknacks on the floor and all the flags flying and the banners and everything. I'm not going to be looking at any of that. I'm not there to see the people of Boston. I am there for one reason, and that's to take care of you, Honky Tonk. You know, there's some things in life I can handle and there's some things I can't. But one is a liar and the other is an imitator, and you're both of those. Imitating a man that's been dead for 10 years, won't give him no respect after making fun of his stuff. Man, why don't you leave this thing alone? Why don't you go out and strike out on some of your own? Now, you played a guitar once, and you had your fun in WrestleMania. But your manager didn't have any fun, now did he? He had the chance to feel the fear, to feel the cold go across his skin, man. It lights you up. And I'll tell you something, Gene, I kind of got off on that in WrestleMania, yeah. A little disappointed Davey didn't swallow that little twerk, but that's all right. That's the way I am, though. You know that. You know, I've always had a theory about life. And that theory is, it's very simple. The man who dies with the most toys wins.
You don't really think of Jake Roberts as being one of those people that would dole out life advice. Well, you would be wrong, because a month from this point on Wrestling Challenge, I found a thing that says Jake Roberts PSA drugs, and I kind of held my breath going in because I didn't know if it was going to be pro-drug or anti-drug.
You know, there's some things in life that you can do and have fun with, but there's a lot of things in life that you shouldn't do, such as drinking and driving, smoking cigarettes. They ain't no good for you. Cheating on your wife or just getting caught, maybe. But you know something? I'm Jake the Snake Roberts, and I might play around with snakes, and I might play around with a lot of things. One thing I'd never play around with is drugs. I'm able to stand up and be a man on my own and say, no, I don't need that to have a good time. I got better ways and live longer.
He does not play around with drugs. We have to make that clear. He's a serious professional, just like El Dandy. Why don't we just go into the next match, which is the return of Killer Kong in the WWF. I'm sorry. I still can't stop thinking about the time on Mid-South Wrestling where it was spelled K-A-H-N. It never fails to make me laugh. Kong! Kong! often talk about how Andre the Giant would go around to various territories and kind of rescue the lead babyface as kind of a fixer of sorts. Killer Khan is the flip side of that equation. Although, you don't really hear much from him after this 1987 run. He just go from place to place and terrorize the local babyface. In some cases, maybe even Andre would be brought in to protect whoever against Killer Khan. Hocking back to that 1981 feud between Khan and Andre the Giant. And maybe they're looking for similar magic here. I mean, after all, Khan would be mixed up with Hulk Hogan later in the summer. They filmed a segment, I believe it was on the Snake Pit, where Khan blew mist in Hogan's face, but it did not air in all the markets, curiously enough. Of course, when I wrote an article on my blog years ago in proposing a SummerSlam 1987 card, or at least what it would have looked like, my main event was Killer Khan versus Hogan in a cage. I really wasn't quite sure if that would be good enough. Also, thinking about Killer Khan is Khan's hot dogs, not exactly my favorite hot dog brand. I'd say number one would be Sabret's Natural Casing. That I think that's a clear number one for me. I also like KM Frank's because it's a more New England sort of thing. I do think Nathan's is a little bit overrated. It kind of gets that New York vibe behind it, but I don't really care for it that much. And you say, well, why the hell are you talking about hot dogs, Pete? Well, number one, I'm hungry right now. Number two, I really miss SK hot dogs, which were discontinued a couple of years ago, the ones that they would serve at Baltimore Orioles games. And finally, do you really want me to play the Mr. Fuji inset promo? I mean, he really kind of adds nothing to the act.
You look at your... Look at face. Very handsome man. Very vicious. Even this is Mongolian. Very good man. He loves to make people suffer. Look at face. Very good.
I don't want to turn this into the Bash Mr. Fuji Festival or anything, so why don't I take it from the other end? What is the greatest Mr. Fuji managerial promo of all time? And why is it that 1988 Survivor Series thing where he attempts to explain why he turned on Demolition? It's because he said the word britches in it. Their britches were too big for them. Who uses the word britches in a promo? Only Mr. Fuji. Certainly the highlight of his managerial career. Well, that and coughing up the world title at WrestleMania 9. That was also rather interesting. Killer Khan's offense is not particularly diverse. He's more of a throwback sort of character. It's a knee to the chest, a sidekick, a side backbreaker. I guess the sidekick was sort of okay, I guess, since he's a big dude. And while he used to do a top rope knee drop back in the day, he's now downgraded to a second rope knee drop. And that is how he picks up the victory here. I don't really know what to say. I mean, but you get this character in for one final run. I guess it makes sense. I like the Harley Race angle, or put him on house shows against Hulk Hogan. I think makes more sense to me because you have the Heenan thing. But I guess you're going to have to mix somebody else in, and you've already used up Kamala for that. So, I don't know. I guess this one's fine, too.
All right, fans, tonight here at the Boston Garden, from top to bottom, an absolutely phenomenal card. Golden Boy, Dan Spivey, Blackjack Mulligan, Pete Doherty. By the way, the Duke of Dorchester to me speaking tonight.
Well, at least one of those three guys turned up at the Boston Garden that night, and it was not Dan Spivey, and it was not Blackjack Mulligan. Of course, Pete Doherty was going to be there. I mean, it's a pretty short commute from Dorchester up to the Garden. Back in 87, I think... Can't remember. He could have probably just taken the orange line there. I guess it all depends what part of Dorchester he was actually from. They never kind of drilled down for that kind of detail. Maybe I could actually look that up and find out what street he lived on. See if he would take the red line from Andrew Square, or if he was taking the orange line from, I don't know, Green Street or something. I don't know what the hell the exact borders are. So Mulligan, he disappears around this time, but you're going to hear from him a little bit later on in this show for an interview, which is interesting because, like I said, he doesn't show up. He appears on TV for the final time a couple of weeks down the road. But I want to focus right now on Dan Spivey, the Golden Boy, the fake Barry Windham at one time, alongside Mike Rotundo. And interestingly enough, okay, he disappears as well for much of the middle of 1987. But he comes back as randomly as a heel, because he's facing baby faces on house shows, and you don't I don't even know if you even really see him on TV at that point. But what's interesting about it is he comes back in September and he fills in for B. Brian Blair, teaming with Jim Brunzel, and he turns on Jim Brunzel. But this does not take place on TV, not even on primetime wrestling, not even on freaking wrestling spotlight. This occurs at a house show in Omaha, Nebraska. And then Spivey continues wrestling as a babyface, oddly enough, for, you know, several days more. And then he kind of goes into the more regularly scheduled, you know, he's facing the lower card babyface jobbers as a heel. Just kind of a strange thing. So we actually do have an interview here. And it is Bobby the Brain Heenan. And the expectations, when I see the Brain and Mean Gene on screen together, maybe I just, there's always a magic there, but maybe I just set the expectations too high every time, where I'm expecting absolute gold and greatness 100% of the time.
By this gentleman, Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Say it again. Hulk Hogan is what?
Heavyweight champion of the world.
Good, because tonight when he hears that, World Heavyweight Champion Hulk Hogan, you're only going to hear it one more time. And that's when you hear it the first time.
You said that before.
I'm talking. Do you mind? Show some respect. And when it's all over and done, when that smoke clears tonight at the Boston Gardens, as Hulk Hogan's carcass lays there, you're going to hear something different. A new heavyweight champion of the world, the king of professional wrestling.
All right. A big one for you. Once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, as they say.
Maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to you, Mr. Oakland. But I have not let opportunities pass me by very often. You know the history of my career. I could stand here for an hour and relate to you about what the accomplishments of the king. But tonight in the Boston Gardens will be the epitome of the king's wrestling career.
I guess somebody could have stepped in and said, hey, Harley, that's not really what epitome means, but who's going to say that to Harley Race? Really? He might have been wanting to say epic or something, you know, E-P-O-C-H, the beginning of a distinctive period in the history of someone or something, which I guess this kind of is for Harley Race as the king. They do make at least an acknowledgement of his career. They're not pretending like this is some guy who is now here and has never accomplished anything before. So, you know, that's why I don't have as much of a problem with the king stuff. Yeah, the robe and the crown were certainly goofy, but everybody had to do goofy stuff, more or less, in the WWF of the time period. And some people were just goofy. For example, Outback Jack is up next to tell us all about a food product.
You know, Australia, you heard that the United States is the land of apple pie and ice cream. Well, I don't know about apple pie, but ice cream is sure good.
Ice cream's all right, I guess.
Yeah, okay, Vince. Ice cream is all right, I guess. Who says that sort of thing? If the feds had indicted him for not liking ice cream, I definitely would have gotten behind that prosecution. I mean, unless you're lactose intolerant, which, you know, I understand. I have great tolerance for those who are lactose intolerant. I get it. As somebody who has really fallen in love with almond milk over the last 6 months, I certainly have to say that. Now, the ice cream bars have made a comeback in recent months, I guess. It hasn't been that long. It's not like I go down the freezer aisle in the supermarket, because it's basically like I'm playing guys' grocery games and trying to get in and out of there as quickly as possible. And besides, if I buy those ice cream bars that they have now, they're not on a stick, you'll probably all end up having, they're probably all Seth Rollins, which means that they're just major disappointments.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take you to an unusual tag team combination, I believe, well, dining on something else. The combination of Dr. Martell and Zinc, as a matter of fact. Let's take you now to Kambala and Sika.
That looked like dinner at Bruno's. That's the thing I love about Bruno, even in this period where he doesn't say very much, is when Jesse would make a joke at Bruno's expense, he would just sort of roll with it and laugh it off. Like, you get Sika and Kamala just eating live lobster and making funny noises. Like, it sounds like, it looks like dinner at Bruno's. And then Jesse, before the next match, asks if his mother, Bruno's mother, ever made lobster like that. And Bruno's like, my mother was a wonderful cook. A lobster is fairly high in cholesterol. Not as much as eggs, though. And, or squirrels, for that matter. Nevertheless, be that as it may, as it were, back to live action. Up next, we do have the Can-Am Connection, who they're apparently setting up some sort of Kamala Sika feud with those two guys, Rick Bartel and Tom Zank. They're taking on Dusty Wolf and Rocky Stone. It's the jobber team of two guys who had to change their name for mysterious reasons. Dusty Wolf, because Dusty Rhodes was coming in and we can't have two Dustys, so he becomes Dale Wolf. And Rocky Stone became Tom Stone somewhere, and I don't know why that was. I don't think it was because of Rocky Johnson. Maybe it was perhaps because of The Rock Don Morocco. Who really knows? Something that I notice about Tom Zank, he looks dead inside at all times in the WWF. And just reading the backstory of him and Martel, he always seemed to have some sort of weird chip on his shoulder for like overpay. And it's strange to think that the highest money territory at that time, clearly the WWF, just based on the business that they're doing, a lot of guys were just upset with their pay. I don't know why that is. I'm not going to break it down like were the Can-Ams on the same house show as Hogan, which always had a big effect if Hogan is drawing a bigger house. I mean, who really knows? Part of it might be that Rick Martel was making more than Tom Zink, which I think is justified on the basis of he's a former world champion in the AWA when the AWA world title still meant something, and Tom Zank had only been in the business for a few years. So I really don't get that whole line of complaint by Tom Zank. Like, oh, I was doing most of the selling in the matches. Well, I'm sorry, you're not Rick Martel. You don't have that cachet. And even throwing out the AWA stuff, Martel has a history with the New York audience as a tag team champion back in 81. Granted, we can't, you know, trot out Tony Garea anymore at this point, but Tom Zank, you'll just have to do. As Rocky Stone, he pulls hair on Martel a couple times. What's interesting with Jesse Ventura is most of the time if you have a pretty boy tag team like the Rockers later on, Jesse would just, you know, bag on those guys constantly for double teaming. But what's interesting is Jesse is giving credit to the Can-Am Connection. As we get an illegal double team by Stone and Wolf, Martel is able to kind of get out of it. He monkey flips both of them. And then when Zenk gets in there, he hits a really kind of sloppy looking drop kick that was off an Irish whip. It looks like he got up there late as all four men end up in the ring. You get that thing where the Can-Ams get Irish whipped out of opposite corners, and when they meet in the center, they do that do-si-do thing. Zenk follows it up with a proper drop kick. I guess that's sort of a make good for what was happening earlier. And then he locks in the Boston Crab. Tom Zenk does on Dale on Rocky Stone. Dale Wolf comes in and makes the save, and I'm scratching my head like, huh. So Rick Martel is known for the Boston Crab, and here is Zenk locking in the move. I mean, I guess it's okay. You pick stuff up from your partner. As they get a little offense, Stone and Wolf, because Zenk is doing the selling, as he kind of complained about here. But again, he has to be the guy selling in order for Rick Martel to come in and be the House of Fire, because that is what he's really good at. Although Martel could certainly sell his ass off as well. He grabs Wolf, drop kick, and they hit what's kind of like, he tags Zenk back in fairly quickly, what's sort of like a heart attack move, but with a drop kick in lieu of a clothesline. And the slingshot splash by Martel from the apron inside to the center of the ring finishes, and the Can-Am Connection is victorious. And again, Jesse Ventura openly praising a tag team like this just strikes me as very unusual.
Another tag is made. What's going to happen here? Slingshot and a cover. And a freak out.
Very good teamwork, I have to admit it. The tags were fluid. They got in and out, did their damage, and got the win.
probably pointless to try and think of a reason why Jesse is lavishing them with such praise. Is this because him and Zank are both Minnesota guys? That might be part of it. I'm not sure. Or the fact that Ventura has a history with Rick Martel going back to the AWA and, you know, there's a certain familiarity. Well, I don't remember him putting him over too much in Strikeforce, but I don't know. Maybe Jesse decided to go in a different direction here for whatever reason. He does certainly work in mysterious ways.
Hold your horses, because I am the roughest, toughest thing that has ever come out of West Texas. Now let me tell you something, Ronnie Bass, and you had better let that stick in your craw, and you had better get that straight, because you can settle, you can say anything you want to about Black Jack Mulligan. You can call me a polecat. You can call me an udder puller. You can call me anything you want to. But Ronnie Bass, the apple of my eye, you had better leave alone. Because Sarah Jo Puckett just happens to be one of the main things in my life. Just because she's a little plump. And because they got a few teeth missing.
What does she look like?
She's 200 pounds on the hoof. Don't you worry about, brother, because she drives a pickup truck. Because she likes Willie Nelson tapes, brother. Because she can ride a big bull, brother. Don't get me upset, Beth. Sarah Jo belongs to me, brother.
Blackjack Mulligan is more of a character of the 70s rather than the 80s, despite it being 1987 at this point. He just would kind of come and go from the WWF at these odd times. Yes, he was an Andre opponent back in 82 time frame. I think he also faced Backlund at various points. But here, he's coming off the run as the Big Machine, as a member of the Machines, late in 86, and then he gets to be himself again. But Outlaw Ron Bass really gets screwed over by this feud and the fact that Mulligan just suddenly disappears. It's kind of fun. I mean, because he does not get a feud until close to WrestleMania 4. He's just floating aimlessly for about a year. Yeah, I guess maybe you could count Sam Houston and beating him up, but that really amounts to nothing. Mulligan disappears after appearing on Superstars 2 weeks after this date. You don't see him anymore. And it's funny how Bass and Brutus Beefcake, in the aftermath of WrestleMania 3, lose what was their own feuds. Beefcake with Adonis, who we'll see a little bit later, and Bass with Mulligan. But it takes a full year for everything to come full circle, and then those guys are paired up in a feud that takes Beefcake out of SummerSlam 88.
You know, in recent weeks, we've reviewed the fantastic amateur career of Ken Patera. Now it was the long road from Portland, Oregon to Brigham Young University to the Olympics and finally to the World Wrestling Federation and then to the road to disaster.
What was it like sitting in jail, being in prison? The disgrace I brought upon my loved ones, my family, my friends, the disgrace I brought up myself. I hope to make it right.
Ken Patera leaves little doubt who is responsible for his misfortune.
Everybody gave up on me, Heenan, including you. You threw me down the river. Nobody thought I could make a comeback. But I'm back, Heenan, and I'm back for good.
Naturally, Bobby Heenan has vehemently denied any responsibility for what happened to Ken Patera.
And I'm going to set the record straight now. I had nothing to do with what happened to this man. Anything he earned in this career, anything he got in professional wrestling is because of me, my mind, my attitude, and the way I directed him. What he did outside that ring is his business. He is a grown adult. He's older than me. He's on his own when the time is his.
That's the video package they played leading up to this Ken Patera-Bobby Heenan debate that they're going to have in the middle of the ring. And here's the problem. The last part that you heard is Bobby Heenan on a recent Primetime Wrestling, which kind of an odd, interesting example of them using Primetime Wrestling for angle advancement. That not a lot of times would they do that in 1987. 89, they're using it a lot because you have the Piper, Rude, Heenan thing, Red Rooster, and Brooklyn Brawler, that sort of stuff. But 87, not as much. But then again, you have a lot of time where people are away from TV. So, and you didn't want to film stuff before WrestleMania, maybe necessarily, to let people know where they're going. So why don't we just go right to the center? Actually, I do want to say, what Heenan says about what he does when he's away from me is objectively correct. But Heenan has so much heat off of the Andre the Giant turn that, You really can't say that if you're going to respect and adhere to kayfabe, which, of course, well, I do sometimes here on this show. So our moderator for this debate is Jim Lehrer. Oh, wait, never mind. No, it's me and Gene Okerlund. Thank God, because Gene Okerlund would have done a better debate than Lehrer did in the 2000 foreign policy presidential debate. And yes, I'm still pretty pissed off about that 20 years later. One thing I do have to note about Okerlund, holy crap, is he tan as all hell. For a second, I thought he was in blackface, and I'm like, Gene, what are you doing? You can't do that, even in 1987. But then again, a month off will do that. If you're spending it on the beach in Aruba and just drinking bright blue cocktails the entire time. Although I guess Gene might have been having some other stuff as well. They're billing it as the first wrestling debate, which I'm not going to argue with, but it certainly isn't going to be the last. You had those face-to-face segments right before WrestleMania 5, but the most famous, ridiculous one is the one over the Iraq War in 2003 between Chris Nowinski and Scott Steiner. And I have, even, you know, removing any feelings I might have about the Iraq War, I don't even know who to go for in that. Do I go for Scott Steiner, who objectively portrays himself like an idiot? Or do I want to go with the smarmy, know-it-all Chris Nowinski, everything in contact sports is horrible, but yet I have not said what exactly the plan is at the end of this? That's my whole problem with Nowinski's work with head injuries, is like he never seems to explain what should be at the end of this, but I really don't want to talk about him. Gene Okerlund goes over the rules of this debate, which I kind of wish Howard Finkel was there, because I think his two-minute explanation, like he would do at the top of the Royal Rumbles, would be much better. But Gene is a perfectly good feeling. At least it's not Mel Phillips telling us what's going on.
First of all, both men will be given equal time for opening comment. They will be given equal time to state their respective cases along with the appropriate rebuttal. And finally, they will be given equal time for closing comment.
I do kind of wish that they had a dress code, because Patera turned up in his wrestling gear, which is kind of funny, not to the level of Andre the Giant showing up for Uncle Elmer's wedding wearing the banana hammock and nothing else. Okay, that's fine. Heenan's in his usual sort of tracksuit thing. I guess it wouldn't make sense, given what's coming, if he wore that dinner jacket waiter thing from WrestleMania 3, the white one. I mean, that's only for the big events. But Patera gets a decent reaction from the crowd, who had seen these vignettes on TV, because remember, this is being taped April 23rd, so there's been 2 or 3 weeks of vignettes leading up to this. And he had said that he was going to rid the world of Bobby Heenan. Just remember that phrase. Mainly because that sounds like a parole violation. That, okay, I know, just strict kayfabe here. Is, I want to rid the world of this guy and you're going to let him out of prison. Because he was sentenced to 2 years in jail and 6 months probation. Or maybe a probation violation, what have you. But Patera, in reading about that case, while he might not be the nicest guy in the world and is completely miscast as a babyface here, I mean, which just seems obvious, it's just maybe even not worth it to go through that talking point again. Bottom line is, the guy probably got railroaded, him and Saito, as a result of a judge delaying the trial out so that it'd be closer to the judicial election, which they do in the state of Wisconsin, which would then allow him to publicize the case and just kind of make a big deal out of it. Whereas it would ordinarily be a $500 fine and at most 30 days in prison. This guy ends up getting 2 years. He gets released in December of 1986. So he had been out for a little while. Now, Bobby Heenan insists upon starting this, which is kind of funny, because the Gene just then says, okay, Bobby, now you can start.
First of all, it is a disgrace for a man of my stature and what I've accomplished and done in professional wrestling to have to stand in the presence of a man who should be locked away and have the key thrown away, a man like you. I'm talking to you, ex-con.
Heenan's coming out pretty strong, but what's interesting to me is that he never mentions what Patera actually did. So if you're somebody sitting on your couch in 1987 and watching this, you're kind of thinking, okay, he did time. And even if you do the math in your head that he was here a little bit less than 2 years ago, so he did a couple of years in the joint. What exactly did Patera do if they didn't necessarily know what was going on? It's almost like Nails, where they didn't say anything of how he ended up in a Cobb County prison. So you're just kind of assuming the worst just based on what Heenan is saying. But then again, heels lie. Him calling him ex-con, which he's going to repeat over and over again. My father was a pretty mild-mannered guy, except for one thing, where that would be his nickname for the hockey player Craig McTavish, who he would call ex-con because he killed a woman while vehicular homicide while driving drunk in Peabody, Massachusetts in 1984, and he missed the entire 84-85 season because he was in prison for that, and then the Bruins let him out of a contract so that he could go sign with the Edmonton Oilers. So he always had it out for Craig McTavish, who then went on to a lengthy coaching career, and I always kind of look at him like, yeah. He's also the guy who pulled out the Calgary Flames mascot's tongue out of his outfit, which I thought was a little off-putting for a ex-con like Craig McTavish. So Patera, while he was a pretty good promo as a heel, because he's not the greatest guy in the world, he's maybe the last guy you would want doing a Lex Express sort of victory tour. I mean, even probably lower than Lex Luger, I think, in terms of glad-handing with the people. He is a little stilted and awkward in stating his case.
I'm proud to live in a country that when a man makes a mistake, he can pay for it. He can pay his debt to society and leave it all behind him. I paid my debt. And furthermore, I'm proud of my amateur record. I'm proud of the fact that I competed in the Olympic Games in Munich, Germany for the United States of America. I'm also proud of the fact of my professional record. I'm glad to have the opportunity to return to the World Wrestling Federation.
America loves to see the downfall of various celebrities. I mean, there's so many examples through the years. But America also loves second acts. Because the F. Scott Fitzgerald line, "There are no second acts in American life," probably the most misquoted line in all of history. Because the next line in My Lost City, which is an essay that is taken from, is, "I once thought there was no second act in American lives, but there was certainly to be a second act in New York's boom days." And that applies to people as well. And like I said, there's so many various examples. And of course, some politicians as well who probably shouldn't have deserved a second act. It's kind of funny how Gary Hart has an affair and he's basically wiped off the mat immediately, wiped off the map. And ever since then, there's like a trillion politicians that just, okay, we're just going to keep them hanging on for this entire time. But Patera, fine. He sounds a little awkward. Maybe he didn't do Lincoln Douglas debates when he was in college or high school or wherever he might have done. He was not on the debate team. Now, Heenan, he's got a chance to state his case. And again, he's not holding back, in part because he truly believes that he's right, that his responsibilities stop as a manager at a certain point.
You listen up, ex-con, and you listen good. I'm going to tell you something right now that I haven't dreamed up. It's nothing just coming out of my mouth. It is a... Because Patera should be kept behind prison walls. Why? Why should he be kept behind prison walls? It's because Patera is a vicious and violent animal.
You don't believe me? Quote, you read it. That's it.
That was not a truck backing up in the middle of heated speech where it's going beep, beep, beep. That is a censored comment where they ran a scroll across the bottom of the screen saying what Heenan said was so reprehensible that we're going to bleep it out, which goes back to the thing that I've said many times where sometimes it's better if you just censor everything and you make the mind wonder, what is it that he said? I actually reached out to Richard Land to see, is there any video of this uncensored, like a sort of raw feed like they have where they show like the dark matches with no commentary? And apparently it does not exist, so that's too bad. What he actually said, I believe, is Heenan was reading from a Kent Patera parole hearing or something where somebody was arguing against it, and it mentioned a judge's name. And they probably did not want to have that out there, you know, to bring an actual officer of the law, I guess you would call it, into a wrestling angle. So you just bleep it, you solve that problem, and you put the seed into people's minds, like, what exactly is it that he said? Being a dick in a debate like this is an actual valid strategy, and I speak from experience from my freshman year at Boston University when in the discussion section group, I don't remember what class it was, but we had debates on various topics, and I got paired against the girl who was really, really sharp at this sort of thing, and I was like, oh God, I am in a world of crap right now because I'm going to get my ass kicked by her. So what did I do? I dragged it all into the gutter. I was to be for the legalization of drugs, and she was anti. And I was like, how do I do this? So I basically acted like a total jerk, kept using the phrase partnership for a thought-free America. And by the end of it, she was kind of in tears. Now, do I feel bad about it? Absolutely not. Because without giving away the woman's identity who did this, she's very prominent graduate of Boston University. He went on to work at the Justice Department, one of the top litigators in the state that she's from. She was voted that at a younger age. And she actually, a lot of her work is focused on human trafficking, which brings us back to Bobby Heenan, because you could have indicted him on human trafficking charges with the whole Hercules thing in 1987. So Heenan's kind of going in that direction. It, by the way, Heenan in his book said that he wanted to use a different sort of line at some point in this debate, which he wanted to call Patera sticky buns, like the dessert, except sometimes in the prison culture. I mean, if you've seen Oz or any of those sort of things, you know, sticky buns, you could end up with sticky buns, but Vince McMahon said no, because this is not the Attitude Era in 1987. Patera, it's a good thing that Heenan's getting bleeped, because Patera just kind of has his talking points and he's sticking to them, and it's not like he's going to deviate too much.
Listen here, Heenan. Like I stated before, I'm glad I live in a country that gives a man an opportunity to pay his debt to society. I have paid that debt. I'm through with it. And one other thing that I'm glad I'm through with is you and your weasel family.
Can't really criticize the decision to have Patera sort of say the same thing again and in 20 to 25 second increments, whereas Heenan is going on for a full minute. So the whole equal time thing is kind of out the window. It's sort of like a quarterback in football where, yeah, he's a young quarterback and you don't want him trying to do too much. I guess maybe Jarrett Stidham for the Patriots this year. Who knows if there actually is going to be any football at all. But you want to limit the things he's going to do, maybe limit his mistakes. You don't want Ken Patera babyface speaking extemporaneously. Of course, there's that famous blooper where Mean Gene starts laughing when Patera screws up in the middle of it. So you just have him go for 20 seconds, limit the options of what he'll say, and everything's going to be fine. On the flip side, though, and it's probably a good thing that this is not modern era, because people would be laughing at Heenan the same way they did during that rap battle between the Usos and New Day, when the Usos made reference to Xavier Woods in a certain film he may have been in, well, that he was in with Paige. Because the Heenan stuff is pretty funny. But now they have a chance to state their case. And what's kind of odd for this format is that Patera gets to go first, which I think is strange because usually there's a back and forth.
As I was sitting in prison, Weasel, I had a lot of time to think of the Bobby Heenan types of this world. Types like yourself. As I needed moral support, which you granted me, you said that you're going to stand behind me 110%. Nothing was going to go wrong. As I sat in that courtroom during that 7 days of trial, you were never there. You never showed your face. Then as I was sitting in the cell, in a prison cell, not one phone call, not one letter, not one visit. You had completely abandoned me, Heenan. When I was down on my luck, wondering what next, he had to have made some kind of contact, maybe with my family. So I called my wife. I talked to my children. Have you heard anything from Bobby? They said, no, not even a phone call, not a letter, nothing. You had completely abandoned me, which was completely against what you had stated earlier.
Well, I suppose Heenan could have visited Patera in the prison in Wisconsin when the WWF was in Milwaukee in October of 86 or any of the other times they were in Wisconsin. But who knows if Heenan was actually at those shows? I know Stud and Bundy were at the October 86 show at the Mecca in Milwaukee. I don't know how close the city is to where the prison was that Patera was in. But Heenan was a really, as a personnel man, I've spoken about this before, he was pretty cold-hearted. He kind of lived by the get rid of the guy before he's, you know, outlived his usefulness. He's very much like Bill Belichick in that sort of way. I mean, he doesn't have a salary cap or anything, but hey, you know, Ken Patera just wants a shot at redemption, I guess. And Heenan, he's not interested in that because when he's behind bars, he's not going to be able to provide anything for his organization. He's not establishing some sort of friendship in this kayfabe universe with Patera. So you're on your own. You committed the crime while you were off on your own. So really, I'm just going to wash my hands of the entire thing. And Heenan, in his rebuttal, kind of makes the point that I'm making.
First of all, ex-con, I want you to get something straight, and you listen up real good. I'm a businessman. I'm not a babysitter. And what you do outside the ring, big ex-con punk, is your business, not my business. My job is to get you booked in that ring. And as far as calling your wife and your two snot-nosed kids, I could give a damn.
If you think of wrestling managers as being like sports agents, what Heenan just said is the exact opposite of the Jerry Maguire statement of principles, mission statement, whatever it was from the beginning of the movie Jerry Maguire. And got, you know, Renee Zellweger to come along with him, and, you know, the movie is off and running at that point. But Heenan, again, taking a very different state. He's entrenched in his position as we now go to the closing statements where Patera gets to go first. And again, keeps it simple. If they give him a minute, Patera's only going to take 30 seconds. What's interesting to me is they have podiums there. So if they wanted to do 100% scripted promos, Patera could read off notes and have it, you know, come off a little bit more natural, which is why it is strange that he comes off so stilted.
Well, like I stated earlier, Heenan, I'm proud to live in the United States of America. I pay my debt. That's behind me. I'm proud of my amateur record, the blood, sweat, and tears that I poured out in the gym every day to represent the United States of America in the Olympic Games. I'm also proud of my professional record. But there's one thing that I have left to do, something that's going to make me very, very proud. And that is to rid the world of the scum like you, Weasel!
Again, let's be careful out there, Kenny, because it kind of sounds like terroristic threats you're making to Heenan, which might be a probation violation, although perhaps they weighed against the fact that he did over a year and a half in the joint for something that would ordinarily get you 30 days at most from everything that I've read. So he gets a nice reaction at the end, and he's certainly fired up. This isn't the rap battle between the Usos and the New Day. This is something completely different. But Heenan doing that thing, like I said earlier, where being a dick is a strategy in a debate, completely takes the gloves off, or more accurately, a different part of his clothing. That being his belt.
You're not going to walk right up the ladder to the World Wrestling Federation top if I got to get every member of my family and make sure you're mentally, physically, and financially busted. I'll do it. All you ever concerned yourself with was pressing weight. And all you're good for now is pressing license plates. Well, I'll tell you something, pal. You never brought me a championship. You never brought me nothing. All you wanted was a title. All you wanted was a belt. You want a belt? You want a belt? I'll give you a belt.
Heenan mentioning license plates is such a great line, because prisoners do make license plates. It's one of those cliches that you kind of think, well, is that actually true? And yes, it's because prison labor is like 65 cents an hour, and the state needs to find cost savings for stuff like that, especially if they have to pay for their own COVID testing equipment, and the federal government is absolutely no help with it. So he has the belt off and ready to go to just start whipping Patera, which doesn't do a whole heck of a lot, because Patera is able to fend it off. And he sends Heenan for the ride, and Bobby takes an absolutely hellacious bump, where he's got the belt wrapped around his neck, and he's getting Irish whipped from one corner to the other, and Heenan runs and then kind of jumps up in the air and looks like he just absolutely whiplashes his neck. And this is the spot where Heenan starts wearing a neck brace for the better part of 4 to 6 months afterwards. It's gone by the time Survivor Series rolls around. But for the entire summer, it plays out on primetime where Heenan visits the doctor and Gorilla is not convinced of the seriousness of the neck injury. Because Heenan did famously break his neck in the early 80s in Japan because Atsushi Onita, of all people, broke it with a botched leg drop. And I have to say, it is not a good look for an ex-con, like Patera in this case, to be, I don't know, giving a guy whiplash who has a pre-existing neck injury? And also, where is the Heenan family? Did Heenan give them the day off the same way he did with that Johnny V gave off the Dream Team? A lot of managers getting abused on this show. And he does a stretcher job on the way out. I mean, you would think somebody like a Hercules or Harley Race or somebody would be out there to try and help him. But I don't know. Who knows exactly? Everything happened so fast that, you know, probably couldn't have gotten down there to do anything. And as this angle would play out, the family would attack Patera at the end of June. Part of that was to write off Ken for a little while because he did hurt his bicep, which completely derailed this push. I wouldn't have expected great things anyway because he's so awkward as a babyface, but any chance it may have had was kind of ended by that injury, and the fact that he came back with this ugly-ass beige arm brace that just looked completely terrible.
What a ridiculous move for Heenan to attack Patera. That was the dumbest thing he could have done. And as we see now, Patera with that hand. And if I look at him with that belt, he whips him about 4 or 5 feet in the air, snapping his neck. This man is going to be hurt very seriously. And he asked for it.
He's hurt all right. That's ridiculous for a man of Patera's stature and caliber and strength to do something like that.
The rage that Patera shows here, then again, Heenan did start it. I'm kind of more with Jesse on that. But also, Bruno makes a good point. Like, what the hell is Heenan thinking without having backup behind him? And Patera going forward, he's not going to have any moments that are as memorable in his 87-88 run, such as cutting Andre the Giant's hair along with, raping him of his dignity. But in actuality, he was cutting his hair. And speaking of dudes who just got their hair cut, a lot of that on this show with with Beefcake and Johnny V earlier. We see the WrestleMania 3 footage of Adrian Adonis having his hair cut by Brutus the Barber Beefcake, which, having Beefcake do that, now that I think of it, makes a lot more sense than having Piper do it, because now you can show the replay transition into the new feud that you had kind of established earlier, and you don't have to show Piper and remind people that he's not around anymore. So Adrian Adonis is here. He's completely bald now, and they make sure to mention that per the stipulations of the contract, they cut off the rest of his hair because getting it all off in the middle of the ring in the Pontiac Silverdome would have taken a little bit too long, and they were certainly the time restrictions there. And he is taking on Jake Milliman. I don't remember seeing him in the WWF this early, but looking very much like fat Daniel Bryan. If Daniel Bryan decided to eat like a bag, an entire box of Hydrox every single day, or a bunch of Captain Crunch, for that matter. And it looks like Adonis has put on so much weight at this point that he looks like King Hippo from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, but he can certainly still move around the ring. And Jimmy Hart is still there, and he gives the inset promo on behalf of his man.
You know, I know there's a lot of people out there right now laughing at adorable Adrian Adonis. But look at this poor jerk in the ring. Look what Adrian's doing to him. He's not laughing, is he? And I promise you this, Brutus Beefcake and all the other wrestlers out there, when Adrian gets a hold of you, Brutus, you'll be laughing.
One of the things that Adonis is doing in this match is he's tossing Milliman around by his beard. And when I refer to him as Daniel Bryan, I'm referring to the Daniel Bryan from, you know, 2013 to 2015, the one with the beard that we all know and love. And Adonis just locks in the sleeper, good night, Irene, and that finishes very quickly here. And Jesse makes the point that in locking in that sleeper hold, Adonis can use his weight to his advantage because he can sort of lean on the guy and sort of keep him from getting up. But for Adonis, this is the last time you would see him in the WWF. I mean, he dies 14 months after this. He does turn up in the AWA later in the year. He gets fired on April 27th. So the week before this airs, he's gone. But they're not going to cut the match out from Superstars. I mean, it's kind of late in the game for that anyway. And it's just a quick filler thing at the end. And it's not the first time that Adonis got fired. He got canned at the end of 86. I forget the exact reason, but it was in the middle of the Piper feud, which is why you kind of saw it transferring over to other guys like Morocco and Orton. And then eventually Adonis comes back around the beginning of 1987. I think it's the Saturday Night's Main Event in January of 87. That's why Adonis, when he gets hit with the crutch on the Saturday Night's Main Event at the end of 86, that's why that happened, was it was to write him off as an injury. But yeah, this is it for him, and it's kind of sad, you know, what happened. I don't know if they've done a Dark Side of the Ring with him, but what I will say, despite my distaste for that show, the fact that they ran an episode of that where John Stossel is getting his ass effed up by Dr. D. David Schultz, one of my heroes, that's one I'm definitely going to have to rewatch down the road.
All right, Boston, you've got your work cut out for you. I don't mind telling you. Get your tickets in advance. Get them in a hurry for one of the most phenomenal wrestling cards that you're ever going to see in this great city with such a tremendous tradition for great professional wrestling.
I know I've definitely seen this card from the Boston Garden because in my old job, well, two jobs ago, when I was working at home, I could put wrestling on in the background because I didn't have to think too hard in my job, and it was what I liked at the time to have on in background. Now I have to think a little bit more when I'm actually like working in the nuts and bolts, so I don't really have as much time for that. And also, 1987 house shows on the WWE Network aren't there for whatever reason. I mean, who knows why they don't put that stuff up? Of course, if WWE gets sold to ESPN or Fox, who knows what happens to the network at that point? I mean, the whole thing might just completely go away. But let me read off the, before we get to our promo, the card at the Boston Garden that night, which I said 11,832 was the attendance. Here are the results of that show. In our opener, Nick Kaniski pinned Frenchie Martin at 11:31. They let Frenchie Martin go 11 and a half minutes in the year 1987. Demolition defeated the Islanders. Iron Mike Sharp pinned Sivi Afi. So what a fall for grace from Sivi Afi in a 15-month span. Hulk Hogan pinned King Harley Race at 9:17 with a roll-up after Race missed a diving headbutt off the top. Sika pinned Pete Doherty with the Samoan drop at 3:07. Brutus Beefcake defeated Johnny V, subbing for Adrian Adonis via submission with the sleeper at 3:24. After the bout, Beefcake spray-painted and cut some of Valiant's hair. Yeah, you got to incorporate the spray paint as well to give an extra thing because you can't cut off all of his hair at once, like I said earlier. Ken Patera, with Jake Roberts, who he was subbing for, pinned the Honky Tonk Man with an elbow drop after Roberts tripped Honky at 9:22. Jimmy Hart joined the commentary team briefly. And the British Bulldogs were defeated by the Hart Foundation via disqualification at 7:47 after Smith used Jimmy Hart's megaphone as a weapon. Danny Davis was banned from the building, as Gene Okerlund said, as he welcomes in his guest, Hulk Hogan. And you think Hulk Hogan in May of 1987, on the Saturday Night's Main Event, this night, first time Hulk Hogan is not wrestling on that show. I mean, it's not just, he has about as rich a tan as Gene Okerlund did in the debate segment, but let's think about it here. He's dispatched Andre, and Hulk Hogan pre and post WrestleMania 3, completely different guys. There are grand delusions now that he's established his legend, and all he can think about is the Pontiac Silverdome. For some reason, I'm thinking of Lord Cornwallis at the end of the movie The Patriot.
Everything will change. Everything has changed.
Yeah, well, for 7 long days and 7 long nights, the heaven, the earth, and the WWF were created, man. And on the 8th day, the big dude upstairs, he created Hulkamania. But he was working overtime when he created the largest arms in the world to protect Surf and put a guard around the three commandments, the prayers, the vitamins, and the training, and even the day the earth stood still. When Andre the Giant slammed at my feet, I believed it would live. Never thought the king would be waiting in the wings, man. You know, Andre the Giant, I saw him sweat when he knew what was going on. The king hasn't shed a drop yet. And was faced with a tombstone of Hulkamania in my eyes, I saw the giant shake. Harley Race doesn't flinch an inch.
You know, Hulk Hogan, I cannot believe how quickly Harley Race has positioned himself in this number one contender's position. The king of wrestling is in the driver's seat, so to speak, in terms of that.
He's in the driver's seat right now. You know, yeah, I'm immortal, man. If you beat me, I'll stand out here and say you were better. If you take the gold, you can have it if you think you can. But the one thing I couldn't live with, Mean Gene, is if I had to bow at his feet, I couldn't live with that.
Hearing Hogan in around this time period, I'm thinking of the phrase. It goes all the way back to actually the 1828 presidential election in the United States, which Andrew Jackson was elected president. To the victor goes the spoils. There's a New York senator who was referring to that. And it's basically a benefit is conferred to the winner just beyond winning the match. I mean, he beat Andre the Giant, who, yes, he lost matches in Japan, Mexico, and all that. But in the framework of the story being told within the World Wrestling Federation universe, shall we say, he gained additional spoils from that, which explains why he would have these grand delusions and would never, ever, ever stop talking about the Pontiac Silverdome, even if he was in the middle of the Superdome at the time. So we go back to Vince, who tells us on next week's show that Ricky the Dragon Steamboat will be in action, defending the Intercontinental title, one of the rare times you would see that on TV, but also a feature match, because again, this is sweeps, this is May, and I feel like I'm in SummerSlam 92, I'm in some sort of time warp, because it's Davey Boy Smith against Bret the Hitman Hart, so two tag guys in action, and they let the two guys, each side speak their piece in advance of next week's bout. I don't really care about what Davey Boy Smith has to say, because he kind of sounds like he has crackers in his mouth. I can barely understand it, but a rare opportunity here for Bret Hart to talk in 1987.
Everybody thinks the Bulldogs are so great. Everybody thinks Davey Boy's so tough. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get Davey Boy Smith one-on-one, and this half of the Hart Foundation is going to whip Davey Boy Smith from one end of the ring to the other, because he's not good enough to ever come close to Hart Foundation. He's not even close to being one half of the world tag.
Bret had a long way to go to become an effective enough promo to be a viable singles competitor in the WWF, especially on the babyface side, because that's where he was for pretty much almost all the time up until 1997. So he just seems so incredibly unsure of himself. It goes back to what I've said in the past, that Jim Neidhart is so important to his career because he gave that team personality. Otherwise, you put another guy who's just like Brett in that team, and they're just two bland Canadian guys, and you don't really think of them like, oh, okay, well, they're two good professional wrestlers. Well, in WWF, that definitely wasn't going to be enough. So that is a wrap for the WWF Superstars of Wrestling from May 2nd, 1987. On other podcasts this week, on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they're taking a look at Texas All-Star Wrestling from 1985, which has Paul Diamond in it. He's a guy, yes, I shined a light on him last week with Paul Adu. Well, they go back a year earlier to when Paul Diamond is teaming with Shawn Michaels in Texas All-Star Wrestling. And on the sportscasters with my good pal Steve Bennett, he has Adam Lazarus on, and they're talking Super Bowl 25. And if there's one Super Bowl that I would watch, you know, during this quarantine, shelter in place, whatever you want to call it, the same way that I'm watching all these NBA games, I would probably choose Super Bowl 25 if I'm not allowed to choose any of the Patriots ones. Because it was such a great game, and I don't understand, looking back at it, how the Giants were a 7-point underdog. I brought this up to Steve, and he said, well, the Bills had won 51-3 the week before. But my thought is, the Giants went into San Francisco and beat the Super Bowl champions, held them to 13 points. Yes, they did knock Joe Montana out of the game, but it's not like Steve Young was any sort of slouch coming off the bench. Actually, Steve Young was a tremendous slouch, as I recall. You know, it took him several years to win a Super Bowl with that 49ers roster. So do check out those podcasts as well. I do have some changes coming to Greetings from Allentown coming up. I'm not quite ready to announce what that is, but you'll be hearing that in due time, I can assure you. Now, next week's show that I'm going to be doing, and I've planned everything up through next week, and I've talked about how this whole thing feels like Groundhog Day a couple of times now. So it's only appropriate that I found a wrestling program that actually aired on Groundhog Day, February 2nd. This is 1991 WCW Worldwide. And this is a biggie because it's got a couple of different things going on. First of all, there are two title changes on the show, which is very rare for a one-hour program. But two different belts are going to change hands, but quite frankly, I'm in it for the announced team of Tony Schiavone and Kevin Sullivan. And Kevin Sullivan, in the screen cap to the video, you can see what he is wearing, which is a Boston Red Sox t-shirt with suspenders on his pants. I mean, I cannot, oh my God, I love that so much, even though I'm not a fan of the Red Sox anymore. I just can't get enough. Kevin Sullivan's going to be bringing the Boston accent. I can assure you in that one. Again, I thank you so much for listening. And do leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown, wherever fine podcast reviews are accepted, such as Apple Podcasts, iTunes, whatever you want to call it, whatever message boards might be looking for podcasts about NBA / wrestling programs. Because I have to talk about other stuff during this, or else I'm not going to get through it. But you talking about this podcast provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular program. Another thing I have to throw in is I do a YouTube comment theater here. You know what? Why don't I just do one real quick? I'm going to warn you, though, the quality of these comments aren't particularly great because these are actual YouTube comments left by what I can only assume are actual users, although it gets a little batty as you go down into this. It's still real to me, damn it, says, first appearance of the barber. Way over with the people from the start. A great character. And yeah, I don't really care if it was because Pat Patterson got himself off on hairdressers or whatever the hell it was. They actually did a hair angle with Pat Patterson in the summer of 1987 up in Montreal. It was one of those Montreal-only deals. I think they set it up during the Pat Patterson talk show segment that aired on the Quebec WWF TV. it's still real to me. Damn, it also adds, I can't believe people would disrespect Macho Man like that while he's giving them the business. Outrageous. Okay, yeah, I sort of agree. BP Cruiser says, Macho Man and that college graduate music. And it's got the little tears emoji coming down the face. Yes, that had been around since 1905. That music. So you think of that as being around forever, but at this time, 87, only a little more than 80 years. Barry Kelleher says, and this is where it goes off the rails, I thought no people attend Superstars of Wrestling due to coronavirus. So a little misspelling there. And then we get a couple of replies. Are you feeling lucky, Punk? Replies, sure, why not? World of Wrestling, who is the uploader, replies, yeah, coronavirus is so powerful that it is the ability to time travel. And it's still real to me, damn it, who is weighing in quite a lot this week. They didn't let things like that stop them back in 1987, which is why it was the best time in wrestling ever. Take that, 2020. So there's our comment decrying modern wrestling. And Barry Kelleher says, have you WWF Wrestling Challenge January 11th, 1987? And World of Wrestling replies, don't make requests. Or actually said, I might. I guess I did that from memory off another YouTube comment that I saw. I don't know. So, some people don't want to take requests like that. And Isaiah Winbrone says, what channel this show was on? That's kind of a weird way to phrase it. This was a syndicated show. It could have been on any channel in any market. In Boston, I believe it was on 25, WFXT. And the replies from World of Wrestling, I'm not too sure, to be honest. And there's just a lot of replies from the uploader. But Neil Fitzgerald says, Mr. in all capital letters, by the way. So he's like Owen Meany from that John Irving book, Prayer for Owen Meany. Mr. Neil Fitzgerald, thank you very much. Please can help you keep up the very good work. Very good, man. Thanks again from Mr. Neil Fitzgerald. Yeah, I think that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. There is one thing I want to throw out there before I go, is I talked about not watching Dark Side of the Ring because it's just too depressing, but I did want to check out the one from earlier this week with Dr. D, David Schultz, and the John Stossel thing, mainly because Dr. D, of course, I've never hid my fondness for him and the sort of realism he brought to my pro wrestling that I enjoy personally, but it also doesn't hurt that he's slapped John Stossel, who is a smarmy, a prick, as there has ever been in the journalistic field. I mean, yeah, he's a lot of controversies in his career, but right now, John Stossel is just basically one of those dudes. Now, granted, he's on, I think, like the Fox Business Channel. Like, he's not even on, like, Fox proper. So, like, you know, whatever, John. I mean, you used to be with 2020 on ABC News, and now you've basically sold your soul to Fox. That's fine. I don't have a problem with it. But you're also one of those guys who whines, I've been shadow banned. My stupid little 5-minute videos don't get promoted by Twitter because they don't like my point of view. Shut the hell up, John Stossel. Seriously, you're with like a major media organization for the last 35 years. You're not shadow banned. You know what it is? People have realized that you're an asshole, and they've decided to tune you out. And that's why things are the way that they are. Yeah, I don't like John Stossel. I don't like him one bit, especially recently. Yeah, you know, he might have done a few good things, but what a smarmy freaking prick he is. So on that note, I should go out. Again, WCW Worldwide, Groundhog Day 1991. Next week, we will see if Kevin Sullivan sees his shadow. So do tune in then for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Ever concerned yourself with was press and wait, and all you're good for now is pressing light and plate.